This talk today is part three of fundamental aspects of tropical cyclone dynamics. I guess maybe I should call it part five because Carrie has given a wonderful talk and Wayne Schubert gave a wonderful talk, so you can consider those to be part two and three, and Rogers to be part four, and this to be part five. I guess Andy's is also, of course,
My talk has nothing to do with this thing.
Okay, so what I want to talk about today is a topic that I've had a lot of fun with and I think is quite interesting and fascinating. Some might say that we're making much to do about nothing after all. Big worlds cascade to little worlds and little worlds cascade to smaller worlds and feed on their velocity and so on and so forth. What's the big deal? But actually, I think that there's actually a very fascinating and interesting questions to be learned about these big worlds in our atmosphere, and in particular, about the basic fluid dynamics and thermodynamics of these big worlds and the smaller worlds that they spawn. And Carrie has given us a nice tutorial on the thermodynamics of the birth phase of hurricanes, and I want to just talk about this topic, which is, I call it the Hurricane Entrance Turbo Booster. You'll learn what that means for those of you that have not seen the talk. For those of you that have seen the talk, I apologize for giving it twice. But the story will be updated, and hopefully it will be more interesting today. But this topic really deals with the fundamental question of what governs the maximum intensity of hurricanes. And I want to first say this work is in collaboration with my colleagues whom I've worked with and enjoyed this research with, John Berzing, Mike Bell, Sim Aberson, Mike Black, Carrie Emanuel, and Pete Black. So there's all of you are involved in teaching me this. I got interested in this question because when I was formerly at CSU, and I'm happy to see my friends here from CSU, I would go to these weather discussions during the summertime, during hurricane season in particular. Everyone would be kind of sitting around. Bill Gray, of course, would be leading the discussion often. And there'd be debate about whether or not such and such a storm was going to intensify. And then everyone would take polls as to how strong the storm was going to be. And people would say, oh, according to MPI theory, the storm's not going to be any stronger than X. MPI is the acronym we use for maximum potential intensity theory, which probably should be shortened, as Carrie does, which I agree with, to potential intensity. So I was listening to these discussions, and people, of course, were throwing out different numbers based on ambient shear, sea surface temperature, what latitude was at. And then I started getting interested in this because it seemed like everyone knew what maximum intensity was. We all understood what controls the maximum intensity of hurricanes. Of course, I was naive at that time. Just a young assistant professor, or maybe I just been promoted, I don't remember. But pretty soon people were tossing out names like, oh, Holland's theory predicts this, and Carey's theory predicts this, and Banner Miller's theory predicts this, and Mark DiMaria's ideas predict this. And I started thinking, boy, everybody seems to understand what maximum intensity is, but everyone has a different theory for it. What's going on? Now, one of the questions that has sparked my interest, it was summarized in a nice quote by Hugh Willoughby, in a very nice paper that he wrote for the Hurricane Conference in 1995. Does the eye of a hurricane respond passively to processes operating in the eye wall? So is it calm and gentle, as the poetry would suggest, or is there a region of the eye, perhaps, that may play an active role in the storm's evolution? And these questions lie at the heart of a general understanding of hurricane dynamics. So Carrie suggested that in a very provocative paper that he wrote in 1997. So I immediately started thinking, oh, there's something very interesting here, something fundamental. Perhaps there's things to be understood. So I worked on this with a master's student, Parks Camp, who I didn't acknowledge in my collaboration list, and I should have. So we went back and started rereading all the classic papers. One that comes to mind was Banner Miller's paper, Malkus and Riehl, and then we started reading various papers. I'm not going to go into the details. I don't have time to go into all details on this subject. But just to contrast one attempt at trying to understand the maximum intensity of a hurricane was the paper by Real and Malkus, Malkus and Real. And they derived an expression for the maximum tangential wind in terms of the parameters of the problem that they thought were important. There's a fig leaf constant out here of 0.9, there's a square root, this is a sensible heat transfer coefficient, this is a friction coefficient, this is the depth of the boundary layer, and this is the temperature difference between the water, the sea surface temperature, and the air. And, you know, they made some plots and graphs, and they said, you know, here's the theoretical upper bound for parcels of air spiraling into the boundary layer, and those parcels of air, as they spiral in, if their inflow angle is not too steep, kind of talked a little bit about that this morning in Roger's talk, then they're going to be able to acquire very large amounts of moist enthalpy and moist entropy heat. So in that limit where the circumferential distance traversed by a parcel is infinite, that's basically this limit here, as that goes to infinity, you approach this theoretical limit. Okay, when you look at the theory, at least this theory, and you ask yourself, that's interesting, this is a sensible heat transfer coefficient. It's now known today that the sensible heat uptake from a hurricane is a factor of 10 smaller than the latent heat uptake. So their theory, the sensible heat transfer coefficient controls the maximum intensity, has no dependence on the latent heat transfer coefficient. And their theory only depends on the temperature difference between the water and the air. We've learned more recently that's more fundamentally dependent on an entropy difference. So they only have part of the picture here. And in fact, their theory was fundamentally flawed for at least two reasons that I've just indicated, and also because they don't have any dependence on the cold outflow temperature of the Carnot machine. Okay, well, Carey has articulated this, I think, quite nicely, and he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for creating a very nice picture and a conceptual model for how the hurricane works. And the basic idea, fundamentally, is that when radiation is absorbed at the ocean, it's re-emitted at a much lower temperature. That absorption-re-emission process creates entropy, because the emission temperature occurs at a lower temperature than the absorption temperature. So there's an entropy production just in the atmosphere in general, and hurricanes basically are able to manifest that entropy production as high winds in the boundary layer and dissipate that entropy that's produced in the column atmosphere. Okay, now this plot is kind of a cartoon of the basic Carnot machine that was articulated in an earlier paper in 1997. And unlike Real and Malkus, the maximum wind speed, you could take the square root of both sides, that's fine. The square of the maximum winds, okay, the radius of maximum winds, this is radius, that's height. Here's your cartoon for the Carnot cycle, the four legs being the two adiabats and the two isotherms. It's a natural piston, a natural engine. The square of the tangential wind is proportional to not just the enthalpy, not just the sensible heat transfer, but also the latent in the form of a composite coefficient of transfer, which is the enthalpy divided by the drag coefficient. Okay, so that's one place that this is updated from Real and Malkus. The other place is that it's not dependent on the temperature difference between the atmosphere and the ocean, but the entropy difference. Okay, the entropy difference, of course, you can't just evaluate this a priori because you don't know what the surface pressure is underneath the base of the eye wall where these parcels are assumed to spiral in and begin their ascent through the wall cloud. And that's something that's unknown. You have to solve for that. So that's part of this. That's part of the problem. And the other place that the Real and Malkus theory was updated was in this factor here. I apologize if it's blurry. It's blurry for me. This factor of epsilon. So epsilon is the Carnot efficiency, which is the difference in temperatures divided by the sea surface temperature. Now, this theory has been updated to basically convert the dissipation that occurs in turbulence into heat, and then to recycle that heat into useful work. I'll come back to that a little bit later, but it doesn't change the basic concept. It doesn't change the basic formulation. So the theory at this time was one of the ways that was demonstrated to be correct was the fact that the theory depends, it says the kinetic energy density of the hurricane depends linearly on this inverse Prandtl number. That's essentially a Prandtl number. So it's a Prandtl number based, it's a viscosity coefficient divided by a heat transfer coefficient, or a thermal diffusivity and a momentum diffusivity, reciprocal. So if it depends, if this is the correct theory, then if you double the inverse Prandtl number, then you should double the kinetic energy density, etc. So you plot the Vmax as a function of Ck over Cd. Indeed, it goes, varies approximately as the square root of Ck over Cd. Okay, well, some of these ideas were summarized and reviewed in a paper that I wrote with my student, who's now works, I believe he works in Florida. He works, he's a national weather forecaster. He works at the National Weather Service. So he's a real weather guy. And basically, there was another gentleman who's a colleague of mine and some of your colleagues in the room, but he has proposed the theory that essentially generalizes a theory that I haven't talked about based on Banner-Miller. And let's just say that the outcome of his theory is, I believe, highly suspect. And according to our review of the status of the theory, that Carrie Manuel's theory came out on top because it's energetically consistent and it seemed to be the most complete description of the energetics of the problem. It didn't have any energetic inconsistencies like, for example, it doesn't seem to be producing energy from nowhere. Whereas in the Banner-Miller ideas, okay, kind of the simple ideas, I guess I'm going to go to the board and I'm going to slow down. The simple idea is you've got parcels of air rising in a column, and then this is not just one parcel, it's a whole mass of parcels rising up through the troposphere. Hydrostatically, the weight of that column that results from liberating the latent heat of condensation as the vapor condenses. Okay, that's what we would call the single cell model. Okay, from a single cell ascent, you can basically only get about 10 millibars hydrostatically, 10 millibar deficit of pressure relative to the environment. If you couple that, if you then postulate that that air must then subside in the eye, okay, and you assume that some of that air can get mixed into the eye wall, so it's diluted, then basically you can pick up, this would be a two-cell model, where the air basically is imagined to undergo two-cycle process. It lifts to the tropopause, and from the tropopause it's subsiding, driving radically to the surface. Of course, this model can produce realistic pressure differentials, something on the order of 100 millibars, 50 to 100 millibars or something, maybe perhaps more. I mean, actually use 100 millibars if you do it right, depending upon where your equilibrium level is in the troposphere, where you assume the partial ascent, basically partial temperature has the same temperature of the environment. So the two-cell model can give 100 millibar pressure difference. But now it has the problem that the temperatures here will be exceedingly warm relative to the environment, and that's not observed. Okay, if you were to just subside air 10 kilometers, okay, your temperature in your air parcel is going to be 100 Kelvin relative. So it's going to be quite warm in the core relative to the environment. That's not observed, and it's not consistent with thermal wind balance. And finally, to actually do this subsiding process consumes energy. Doesn't liberate, it takes energy, because that's a thermally indirect circulation. So it takes work to push the parcels down to the surface. Okay, so the Miller arguments, getting off track here, but that's okay. Miller arguments is kind of this two-cell model with mixing between the eye and the eye wall. Keep the temperatures reasonable. Keep them reasonable, close to an observed eye sounding. Our colleague in Colorado generalize this to be a two-cell model with mixing. But instead of just doing a two-cell, he basically iterates this by computing a low pressure at the base of the eyewall and using that to basically define a new environment from which to lift parcels through. And you continue doing this hydrostatic calculation until it converges. Then you add on this eye sounding, this eye substance leg. Okay? This would be contrasted with Villanalcus Emanuel, who acknowledged that the fundamental source of energy in these systems is ultimately the ocean. It's not the atmosphere, but you're drawing convective available potential energy and then warming the temperature column from that. You're actually drawing energy from the ocean. And this actually is consistent with Gary's lecture that he just gave about an hour ago. So I'm not going to go into detail. I'll just say that mathematically, the theory kind of boils down to solving at least the simple theory. As I say, it has been revised a little bit. But the mathematical theory boils down to solving these two equations, one for this parameter A, or 4, for this parameter gamma, which involves the thermodynamic efficiency and the entropy disequilibrium between the boundary layer, air in the boundary layer and the subcloud layer and the boundary layer and the sea surface temperature. Excuse me, this is the ambient entropy disequilibrium. Excuse me. And this equation here. Now, this looks like what I had before, Ck over Cd times this Carnot efficiency. That's kind of implicit in his scaling. And then you have this term in the denominator, and you have this term in the numerator. This term is kind of interesting. Basically, that's the energy that's basically consumed in spinning up an outflow anticyclone. This is flow into the board. This would be the energy that's consumed in spinning up an outflow anticyclone, which basically has absolute motion that's in the anticyclonic sense in the upper troposphere. I'll come back to that in a little bit. So the theory would, depending on how you want to plot it, I'm not using Carrie's plots, I'm using some of our own, but it's no difference. So if you were to take an outflow temperature, say minus 60 degrees centigrade, and you take a sea surface temperature, say, of 27 or 28 degrees, then the simple theory, assuming this Prandtl number of 1, the theory would give you a maximum tangential wind, say, of 58 meters a second. Okay? You throw dissipative heating in, you convert that dissipation heat into work, and you can boost this number by about 10 meters per second at about these wind speeds. Okay. So energetically, it seems very, very plausible, and it is consistent in a large scale sense with what with the data that we routinely have for hurricanes. Data that's routinely, say, available from analysis data or observational data, but it's still pretty sparse. Now, just to point out this outflow anticyclone, it's kind of interesting. If you run an axisymmetric model with a prescribed sea surface temperature, and you kind of do a ridiculous experiment in a sense, you run this thing out for 70 days, why would you want to do that? Not really doing climate. After 26 days, you already get an equilibrated hurricane. This is a radius and height. You get very strong winds in here. We'll come back to that in a little bit. The winds are about 100 meters per second. And sea surface temperatures are only 26 degrees. Okay, so I should just point out that's far and above what the basic theory would predict, even with dissipative heating. But what I want to show out here in this picture is at long times you get this outflow anticyclone. If you continue the integration, the outflow anticyclone essentially fills the entire troposphere. So is there a steady state in this model? Well, this is one way in which I don't think there's a steady state, because if you allow this model to continue to integrate, basically the outflow anticyclone now starts interrupting the inflow from the environment and the vortex starts to weaken. So, and in fact, in terms of the kinetic energy, when you compute the kinetic energy of this numerically simulated vortex, the kinetic energy density is dominated by this outflow anticyclone. That's actually a problem. It's a problem. Maybe it's a I think it's more fundamentally a problem of axial symmetry, not a problem necessarily of the theory.
What was the model again?
This is the right. I haven't gotten into the details.
Is it closed domain or open domain?
I'm sorry?
Is it closed domain or open domain?
It's an open domain. So, in reality, I'm going to point out that in three dimensions, a vortical source, like a mass source, a vortical source is known to produce concentrated jets. Okay, so the outflow actually is concentrated in outflow jets, and in axisymmetry, it's too strongly constrained. So the vortical jets basically can be quite complicated, and they're very narrow, and they could be quite, well, 10 to 20 meters per second concentrated jets. And you see that in satellite pictures, but we won't get into the details of that today. Okay, Rupert Klein will probably bring up this issue tomorrow, so I wanted to help grease the wheels when he discusses this aspect tomorrow in his talk. I saw a little bit of his talk in December. Okay, now, even Carey himself has wavered a bit in terms of how to articulate this Carnot machine in detail. Now, the detail that I'm going to talk about today is in the original theory that he proposed, the isothermal lake came all the way to the center. And the parcels were then, you know, they were assumed to come into the center, essentially reach equilibrium with the underlying ocean. By equilibrium, I mean moist entropy. Their air parcels would be equal to the moist entropy of the saturation, moist entropy of the sea surface temperature. Then parcels were then assumed to skirt out, rise up the wall cloud, and then execute, or you know, close the cycle in this hypothetical situation. This cartoon was later rejected because it didn't have the right dependence on the drag and the enthalpy coefficients in the axisymmetric simulations. So this cartoon was rejected. It didn't change the Vmax, however. Vmax prediction for both of these cartoons is the same. The only thing that changes is the prediction for the central pressure at the center of the storm. That's the only thing that changes between these two cartoons, these two articulations of the Carnot machine. So this is the theory that's been adopted, okay, until relatively recently, and Carey and I have started working on this together. So what I want to do essentially is kind of return to history. That's going to be one of the bottom lines in this talk, is go back in time, and I want to bring something back between these two cartoons that's maybe halfway in between. Okay?
While you're on a figure, if I can just ask a dumb question, is what controls the width of the outflow, the extent of the upper branch?
How narrow it is?
No,
the
how
vertical.
Far it goes out.
Well, I don't really know the answer to that. I guess because I know experimentally, I won't go into details. Experimentally,
you know, for
these outflows can be very strong jets, so the jets can actually be, you know, they can actually traverse hundreds of kilometers. So
the answer, I think, is if there's absolutely no asymmetry and absolutely no friction, it's always time dependent, and it just keeps expanding.
That's what I just showed.
Yeah.
So in axisymmetry, there is no,
though,
there is no.
It didn't seem to go out.
It just takes a very long time.
It just, I'm not going to get into more details. That's okay now. So why would I want to revisit this picture? Well, you know, Wayne and I have been colleagues for years, and Wayne had a student, Scott Hausman, who had run Vic Oyama's model, which, by the way, I should point out, Vic Oyama just passed away, and I think we lost a giant in our field. Vic Oyama didn't write a lot of papers, but he was tough, and he always wrote good papers. And his memorial service is going to be in Miami next week. I'm going to go to it. But Scott Hausman was one of Wayne's PhD students, and I was working with Scott and Wayne, and they developed an axisymmetric hurricane model, cloud resolving, and it was very high resolution, and it was using a spectral element method. And one of the ways that I suggested Scott and Wayne to validate the model was to test their results against a known model that had already been published in which there was an underlying theory for it. So we tested those results. And at very high resolution, we kept getting storms that were exceedingly stronger than the Carnot prediction. So to believe the result, because in this business of fluid dynamics, you won't believe it until you see the proof in the pudding. You won't believe it until you see the results in at least two models. not just one model, because even if you do a convergence test, you could still be converging to the wrong answer. So we went back and I asked Rich for his model and Carrie. And so basically, I'm not going to go through the details of the model, but it is a fairly standard model nowadays. It was derived from Clem and Willemsen in the late 70s and early 80s when they were doing severe storm modeling. It's an axisymmetric model. It has a momentum equation in radial, tangential, vertical direction. It has simple warm rain processes. Latent heat is condensed. Water vapor is condensed. It releases latent heat. It's got a terminal fall speed, 7 meters a second. It's got a very simple poor man's radiation scheme. Makes people that do radiative transfer laugh. Newtonian cooling. It's basic. It's a standard cloud model. And basically, let me just give you the bottom line, and then I'm going to give you an interpretation, which I think is robust, and I'm going to convince you, because Carrie and I have been working, Carrie has proposed a new scaling for this this effect. Basically, at the resolution that was published in 1987, this is time, this is Vmax, this is daily average data, or this is, it's I don't believe, I don't remember the details, it may be averaged on an hourly time scale. But this is Vmax as a function of time. When they published their results, out to 15 days. The the orange curve is theory, and the black curve is the numerical simulation. So, you know, when you publish, when you get a result in which the black curve overlays the orange curve, you're done. You can publish. That's what I would do. But if you want to be careful, you want to at least run the model out longer in time, or you want to double, quadruple the resolution. If you double the resolution, quadruple the resolution, octuple the resolution, you can see there's a very large discrepancy that emerges between theory and the numerical simulation. So of course, the first thing that comes to mind is the numerical simulation wrong? Did you run the model wrong? No. The physics, the answer to this is that the standard Carnot machine, the Carnot cycle, basically has an inflow branch. Parcels of air rise up in the eyewall cloud. They conserve their theta E, and there's an outflow branch. What's going on in the actual model is parcels are actually accessing higher entropy in the eye. Okay, and of course, the highest entropy you can get is the entropy at the lowest pressure at the sea surface temperature. Typically, parcels don't get in that far. Typically, they're accessing entropies of this order, and they're mixing with parcels that are coming in the boundary layer. So this is like a combustion problem. And the combustion chamber is the hurricane itself. And the hurricane core is where the mixing takes place. So that's your combustion zone, if you will. The latent heat is being liberated. Parcels are no longer rising once they get above the surface. For the first several kilometers, actually, this is pressure, they're actually not conserving their entropy. They're actually getting enriched in entropy. They're getting enriched in entropy from higher entropy from the eye. Once they leave that source of enrichment, then they conserve their moist entropy approximately, which as they should.
So now, the fuel tank is the smallest part of the hurricane. Is that a...
Yeah, well, not really.
It
depends.
Not very big, and often we see the really intense...
It depends.
...when the eye is small, right?
No, not necessarily. It depends how large your eyes are, doesn't it?
Right, but they're always smaller than the eyeballs.
Well, the surface-to-volume ratio, something, you know, something like the perimeter is like 2 pi r, and the area goes as r squared. So the surface-to-volume ratio is not necessarily trivial as volume-to-surface ratio, if you will. That's not trivial as r goes to, as r gets large. So it actually can be comparable. But more importantly, it's not the area that matters. It's how much enrichment of entropy you need to produce a significant change. And it may not take that much enrichment. Now, okay, hang on. So let's just do a simple experiment where we just turn off the latent and sensible heat fluxes completely within the eye. So we take the eye and we just turn them off within the eye because, you know, probably just as I was, you're not skeptical. You're skeptical that an eye could play such an important role in the intensity of the vortex. How could that be? We got to remember, parcels out here as they're traversing in, not a very good picture. parcels out here as they're traversing in, they're not gaining much entropy. Carrie just told us why in the previous lecture. There's a lot of drawing of the boundary layer of entrainment from above the top of the boundary layer. So despite the fact that parcels are getting moistened from underneath, there's still shallow cumulus in the environment. It's pushing dry air into the boundary layer. So the entropy gain on the way in actually is not that large. Maybe it's 5, maybe it's 8 Kelvin. You're not going to get a Category 5 tropical cyclone with 8 Kelvin of theta E increase.
But by the way, let me just interject. This is why hurricanes are observed sometimes to go right up to the land where they're getting no entropy. As long as the eye wall is over water, their intensity remains the same. It's a great experiment that proves the point Mike's making. Half the circulation can be over land and it's not bothered. It's just the eye wall.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's going to be one of the conclusions from the talk, is that the big boost in entropy that you're getting in these storms is coming from, in the traditional theory, or the original, the zero order model, is coming from the eye wall. Okay? The eye wall is not very wide either, but the winds are high there. Right? The winds are high. The winds are very large. So you're getting a pretty big boost. Most of the boost is coming from the eye wall. Okay? What I'm saying is now all we're going to do is we're going to basically modulate that by providing additional source of moisture from the eye itself. Moisture and entropy.
It might not be obvious to the non-meteorologist that there's this pressure dependence of the specific entropy. So if you're saturated at sea level temperature, at one pressure you have one entropy, but if you lower the pressure and hold the temperature constant, which is isothermal expansion, by the way, you have a higher entropy. So that's another reason why the highest entropy air is in the center.
Okay, so in this experiment, just summarize the experiment. Don't wave my hands. Vmax is about 90 meters a second. You turn off the fluxes from within the eye. It takes a while. It takes about 10 days, approximately, for the system to try to settle down to a quasi-steady state. Okay, but you basically, in this transition, you lose about 20 meters per second. Okay? So clearly, reducing the fluxes from the eye, okay, are making an impact on the intensity of the vortex.
So what was the control?
The control was it stayed steady at about 90 meters a second. Quasi steady.
Mike, how much of the radial transport in the eye is being done by resolved motion?
It's being resolved. There's transport from the eye into the eye wall by resolved effective motions. And then the subgrid scale processes are essentially taking that enthalpy and basically moving it through the eye wall. That was according to John's thesis when he did a detailed budget of the theta E budget in the eye wall, which was not in the paper because the reviewer thought the paper was too long, but we should have fought the reviewer and said to hell with it. I'm going to publish it anyway. Now, how does this extra energy get into the eye wall? Well, okay, this is a subtle argument because simple mixing ideas of a vortex, if you just take a vortex with a steep vorticity profile, say your vorticity looks like this, say it's almost a vortex sheet, let's say it tends to a vortex sheet, okay, then this vortex, if I plot this vorticity as a function of radius, this vortex, depending upon its environment, I mean, we do have stretching going on. So there is stretching, okay? We do have a vortex curtain around this interior wall cloud, and you are stretching it, okay? But if the stretching is not too large, i.e., deformation divided by the mean vorticity is not large, okay? The vorticity is on the order of 10 to the minus 2 inverse seconds, or maybe in this vortex sheet, it may even be as large as 10 to the minus 1, but let's say it's 10 to the minus 2 to be conservative. The deformation, the convergence might be an order of magnitude smaller. Typically is from the observation. The divergence is maybe an order of magnitude smaller. So we'll say call that the divergence. Okay, the divergence being nabla dot b, and the vorticity being curl of V dot Z direction, okay? So you may quibble, and you would rightly, perhaps rightly so, because the divergence could be a factor of 2 or 3 less, not a factor of 10. But this vortex sheet's gonna break down. And the vortex sheet basically is gonna spawn waves and vortices, and there's gonna be a turbulent process, or a turbulence zone, if you will, of lateral mixing that's gonna ensue in this region. But in conjunction with that, you also have, as Roger has reminded us this morning, you have inflow in the boundary layer, clearly. And you have inflow just above the boundary layer, if you define the boundary layer, say, as the top of the subcloud layer. And so some of that air is going to basically pass through, or it's going to try to pass through this, and if we were a dynamicist, we'd call this an eddy transport barrier. If we were a general circulation person, we might think of this thing as an eddy transport barrier, but we might not, because we know better, in a sense. It's not that simple. Eddy transport barrier would be something like the stratospheric vortex. You'd have a monopole there with a steep edge. That's clearly an eddy transport barrier. This problem is not so simple. It's got a very sharp jump. It's unstable, but nevertheless, there's a strong vorticity on the outside. Inflowing parcels see that, and they're gonna have a hard time penetrating into that center. And even Roger's boundary layer calculations fail when the radial flow reverses. So we're gonna need some sort of breakdown to help accommodate these inflowing parcels to get into the boundary layer, get into the eye. So the mixing plays a role in allowing those parcels to get into the eye, over and above, and access higher entropy, over and above just what you would expect from simple barotropic models where you break the vorticity down, and unless you form a crystal, the mixing process basically tries to weaken the maximum winds, and it tends to spin up in the eye. So these eddies are always trying to exert a cyclonic torque on the eye, constantly trying to mechanically spin up the eye. Okay. Now, what do we actually see when you look at pictures? When you look at pictures of the of an intense hurricane, this was actually out of the book entitled The Divine Wind, which some of you may have heard about. This was taken on board a P-3 aircraft. Pete Black took this photograph, I believe, looking down from the aircraft out the window, looking down into the eye, and you can see this is a remarkable picture because it shows that basically the wall cloud is over here. The center of the storm is here. Here's the wall cloud. Look at how strong the winds are, even in the eye, okay? Look at these huge waves and the foam and spray being generated. And now look what happens very abruptly, what happens to the quality, the color in this image becomes very dark. So the air is actually much calmer in the eye. So there's essentially a discontinuity, okay, in water vapor, almost, between this inner portion of the eye wall, this exterior portion of the eye, and the interior portion of the eye. It's what Carey calls like a spray curtain. It's like a spray sheet, okay, where the winds transition very abruptly in that region. And there's some other pictures. This book is remarkable. I love it. My father got this book. We got it to him for Christmas. And now when I tell him I want to go to Florida, he says, I'm not going to Florida. There's hurricanes down there. Don't you know about this guy, Emanuel? He's written this book. He talks about hurricanes. It's dangerous. So this book is evokes, I love this. This view of a typhoon evokes a scene from Dante's Inferno. So you can see that this turbulent zone is actually quite active in these strong storms. Now, I'm not necessarily trying to convince Andy that these things are always there, but the weight of evidence is starting to accumulate, isn't it, Andy?
Then what things are always
where? That these mesovortices are always present. Oh, this movie doesn't work. Where's James? Where's the fellow that set up the movie? It's not working. Oh, this picture's wonderful. Okay, well, so.
I don't think you're gonna get it for half the time. It's a PowerPoint sort of.
It worked before I came in, that's what I was doing.
On the screen?
No, it worked on the laptop.
No, that doesn't, that's not necessarily a good
thing. It worked on the laptop, it didn't work. Okay, so, all right, so we have these interesting ideas. Got these axisymmetric models that produce what we call super intense storms. We have a revised, we're starting to propose a revised scaling for this effect that predicts this increase in the maximum winds due to this effect. Carey and I were talking in September. I kind of like the terminology. We actually refer to this as the iris. So if you look at an eye, this is the pupil and this is the iris. Depending upon how this, you know, how the storm is evolving, the iris will either dilate, the pupil will dilate or contract, depending upon how much energy it needs. Okay, maybe that's poetry. But I don't have time to go into the revised scaling, but what I want to do is show you some observations, because you might say, number one, this effect that we've diagnosed and proposed as an explanation for the tendency of these models to exceed their MPI, these hyperactive models, you might suggest, number one, it could still be a model artifact. What about true observations? And is this superintensity effect, does it actually exist in three dimensions? This axisymmetry is a beautiful world, but we know that axisymmetry can also be misleading. So my answer to these, we have three-dimensional simulations at relatively high resolution that we've diagnosed. They appear to be super intense by approximately 20 meters per second, or 25 at 2 kilometer grid spacing. We haven't published those yet, and I want to present at least the possibility to you that these storms do exist in nature as well, which is the ultimate test to carry the day. And in fact, not to be pedantic, but in this theory, if we're trying to show that that these ideas are meaningful and are relevant, all we need is one example. Because the theory is not a theory of statistics. It's a theory of dynamics. It's a dynamical theory for the potential intensity. It's not a theory about the probability of maximum potential intensity. It's a theory of the dynamics. It makes certain assumptions, and so all we need is one. So we're in a mathematical institute, so I'm going to invoke that privilege. Now, so the observed case I would present to you as a candidate for being a super intense storm is the storm of Hurricane Isabel, which occurred in September 13th. And when the airplanes were out, I flew her on the 13th. There were three intensive observation periods. This work is done with Michael Bell for his master's thesis. And on the 13th, Isabel was approximately here at about 22 degrees north latitude. We flew out of St. Croix, and every time the observations were taken, I should just point out, the National Hurricane forecasters essentially upped the intensity relative to the Dvorak estimates that were made in between, which is actually quite interesting. Probably not surprising given the current debate on this climate impacts in terms of the accuracy. This peak here is really just an estimate based on Dvorak. There's no in-situ data, okay?
Remind us what Dvorak is.
Can I not get into that? It's just a pattern recognition technique
from
satellite based on how the clouds are evolving in terms of what people have learned over the years to how strong a storm probably is. When you're over the West Pac, when you're over the Indian Ocean, and you got a fleet sailing out there, you want to kind of have an idea of how strong these things are if you have no data at all. So this is where the actual data was taken. And I want to just give some of the people that are not familiar with this field, I want to give them a feel for what type of things are available in doing this. This is just a picture of Isabel. Jim Costin and Wayne Schubert have written about Isabel also. The pinwheel eye, this is her on the 13th, this is her on the 12th, at least at this time, this is her on the 14th. This is a P3, for those of you who don't know what a P3 aircraft is. It's two of them flying along with two Air Force planes, C-130s. Here's a picture taken. But within the eye, you don't see the hub cloud here. I don't believe you don't really see a hub cloud in this photo. This was taken on board the aircraft I was on, but you do see how steep the wall is, as Wayne was talking about yesterday. You see how steep the wall is. It's a magnificent experience. And most of the flights, when you fly through one of these, if you fly at 10,000 feet, if you fly through a mature system at 10,000 feet, they're going to be uneventful. If you fly through a rapidly intensifying system at 10,000 feet, I don't believe what Kerry said, because I think there's going to be a very strong tower activity in the walls, and that would not necessarily be a gentle ride. But if you fly in the boundary layer of these systems, you're also going to have a bumpy ride. And the measurements that I'm going to show you, to summarize quickly, were taken from these GPS instruments that are dropped from the aircraft. They give you the standard PTHW data, pressure, temperature, humidity, and wind with an error bar with a resolution, okay? And from those drops, okay, from an aircraft, you can collect you can synthesize kind of a composite view of what the vortex looked like. Now, you can also do that from the radar. You can do that with radar data. You can do it with satellite data. But I think it's best to use all sources of data when you're trying to develop a composite picture of the storm. Here we have the four aircraft at different altitudes dropping sons. I want to point out that until Hurricane Rita, this storm had the most number of drop zones released into her in man's existence. And you can see as the drops were released, this is 3 days. This is 3 days of data here. So we actually can get we can infer something about the time evolution and the structure change that occurred of a Category 5 tropical cyclone. And you can see these drop zones are basically sweeping out cyclonic trajectories as they're released. These green, blue, black curves are the actual paths of the aircraft as they traverse through the system. Okay? And these are the trajectories of the drop zones as they're released. From these drop zone data, you can construct a composite of the radius, height, and structure, which is interesting in and of its own. And you can see that, say, on the 12th, the Isabel was actually quite tight, what we call a very tight, compact storm. Radius of maximum wind at about 25 kilometers. On the 13th, she grew in size to approximately 40, her radius of maximum wind was about 42 kilometers. And on the 14th, she grew further still to about 50 kilometers. So in fact, during these 3 days, the storm actually grew in size, doubled. Okay? And I'm showing you tangential wind in color, I'm showing radial wind with vectors, and radial wind. Yeah, I've got the transverse circulation in vectors, and the radial wind is contour dash is negative, solid is positive outflow. Okay, now, what's pertinent thermodynamically? Theta E is the pertinent quantity of entropy. So here I'm plotting a transverse section here in the lower 4 kilometers. That's all we had of in situ data. Okay, so the lowest 4 kilometers in radius out to about 60. I'm showing angular momentum, absolute angular momentum. So that's 1/2 Coriolis parameter R squared plus RV. I'm plotting lines of constant M. Okay? And I'm also plotting in color, I'm plotting the theta E values. And you can see if from the 12th to the 13th to the 14th, okay, you can kind of get the impression, I would suggest to you, in both the angular momentum and the entropy, that the angular momentum surfaces are essentially bulging outward in association with this high lobe of theta E air that's essentially protruding into the eye wall. That's one way of interpreting this evolution. Now, it's complicating thing during Isabel was the fact that Isabel crossed the wake of a storm, Fabian, 10 days earlier. So there was a period of time when we flew Isabel where there was a wake of reduced temperatures of about 27 degrees centigrade, where the ambient temperatures were more like 28. Okay? So you might suggest that this is a case that's too complicated to analyze. On the other hand, you can do a simple error analysis, and you can run a model where you actually reduce the sea surface temperatures within the inner core by 1 degree to see on what time scale the vortex adjusts, the maximum winds adjust to this reduced sea surface temperature 1 degree. Okay, you can do a number of those things. We've done that. In fact, it adjusts quite rapidly. It adjusts on time scales of an hour, a couple hours. And that's actually what you would expect because it's essentially a quasi-equilibrium situation in the boundary layer. The winds are very strong. So if the sea surface temperatures underneath the storm are reduced, the winds are going to adjust very rapidly because of those fluxes are going to be reduced. So that's going to reduce the maximum wind speed on time scales of several hours, not days. So we've done that calculation. It's actually in our paper that's been revised. And let me just get to here's the wake that I was telling you about. Here's Fabian's wake. Okay. Here's the ambient sea surface temperature. It's got drifting buoys out there. We've got the radiometer on board the aircraft. You've got to be careful with the radiometer because the radiometer is looking down and looking at upwelling radiation from the surface. And it's being attenuated a little bit. So So we're going to use data from the aircraft obtained at 200 feet altitude. So I just want to point out that the aircraft that I was on actually flew these, Kerry helped design this, these stair-step descent patterns, okay? You're in the boundary layer, and you're flying in hurricane-force winds. So now that's a bumpy ride, okay? This went on for a couple hours, actually. And we went, we dropped, and you can see you dropped at 2,400 feet, 1,200 feet, 900 feet, 600 feet, 400 feet, 200 feet. And when you look out, I mean, this is not science, but when you look out and all you see are breaking waves of about 30 to 40 feet high or higher, and all you see is them for miles, and you think of this little aircraft flying in the boundary layer, you start to think, what would happen if we actually went down into the ocean? What would happen if the engines were to go out?
You'd get some fantastic measurement.
So before I'm going to apply the theory to this case, which is what I would argue this is the most well-observed hurricane, Category 5 hurricane in existence until Hurricane Rita, before I do that, I need to put some caveats on the calculation. The first caveat is it crossed the wake of Fabian. So there's a 1 degree centigrade temperature anomaly. But if you remember from our picture way up above, 1 degree centigrade temperature anomaly, if you go from 27 to 28, it's not going to make that much of a difference. 1 degree will get you about, I think the rule of thumb is a half degree centigrade is about 1 meter per second, something like that. It might buy you 2 or 3 meters a second, okay? That's not going to care. That's not going to shut us down one way or the other.
Wait a minute. That score might be, there's a huge difference between that 1 degree on that diagram where it's assumed the whole large-scale environment is equilibrated with the sea surface.
Yeah.
And a local change.
Yep, that's right.
Where 2.5 degrees will kill it.
I'm not talking 2.5, I'm talking 1.
No, I know, but...
Yeah.
So 1 is, you know, a big fraction of 2.5. It's not a trivial effect locally.
No. We've actually even run the Rotinone manual model with a 60-kilometer disk, 120-kilometer disk, reduced 1 degree centigrade temperature, and see that the maximum winds basically between the control and the perturbed go down very basically linearly with time, and then it kind of recovers over a time scale of a day. So, but this trend here is on the order of several hours. I don't have a plot, I couldn't find it before this talk.
So, we're slowly getting into that competition with dinner here. So.
So the competition with dinner is you guys win. So, I'm going to finish.
No, yeah, I said slowly.
Okay, so we've got the wake, okay? We've also got another factor. We've got the Prandtl number. What is the Prandtl number in the real atmosphere? How do we measure it? Well, that's why we flew these stair-step descent patterns, because we're trying to measure the turbulent fluxes of sensible and latent heat from the back probe on the aircraft, okay? And from the instrument on the aircraft, and try to measure those fluxes. From those fluxes, we can try to work our way down to the boundary, down to the sea surface, and compute an effective stress, a momentum flux, a friction velocity, say at an equivalent 10 meter level, okay? So that's why we did these experiments in these various storms. Now, the high wind regime, okay, is unknown. The high wind regime being, say, between 50 and 70 meters a second, that's unknown, so we haven't sorted that out. There are some earlier predictions that Kerry has had. Kerry and I are trying to revisit this high wind regime and try to pin down what these uncertainties are in the high wind regime. So I'm going to say all bets are off for the high wind regime. Yes, that is ultimately what we want. But here's what they were able to back out so far from the measurements. The drag coefficient increases, okay, up to approximately 2.4 times 10 to the minus 3 after about 30 meters a second, and approximately levels off. In laboratory experiments, and the actual data is here. This is the data collected, okay, in hurricane force winds. And the enthalpy transfer coefficient, on the other hand, kind of hovers around 1 or a little bit less. So it's difficult and dangerous to extrapolate this ratio, this Prandtl number, at minimal hurricane force conditions, though these were obtained in larger winds than had ever been obtained previously, okay? Previously, they only went up to about 20 meters a second. It's difficult and dangerous to extrapolate to the high wind regime, okay? But at the very least, you can make an argument that, say a worst case scenario or is a Prandtl number of 1. Okay, when you do an estimate, you can do the same sort of thing for the SST. So, in our analysis, our best guess for Isabel, outflow temperatures were measured from the Gulfstream aircraft, and our sea surface temperatures. Okay, our best guess on the 13th. Okay, if you make a Prandtl number equal to 1, okay, and you incorporate dissipative heating, okay, so you give it all, you give it as much. You give it as much as you can, it's still less than the actual observed maximum tangential winds. Now you might say, what's the big deal? It's only 10 meters a second, so what's the big deal? Well, that's the upper estimate. This is our best guess. So it's more like 30 meters per second or 20 meters per second off. And this would be if we use the sea blast data at minimal hurricane force winds. Okay, we're like 30 meters per second off. So I would argue that on these 3 days, she was closest to her MPI, okay, on the 12th, in this upper limit. She was probably farthest from her MPI on the 13th, and somewhere in between on the 14th. But there are large error bars. I think that's the important point to make. We have, from the data that we had available, there are still large error bars involved. Okay, but I would suggest that this is a storm that has exceeded its MPI, its PI. All right, so I'm not gonna. Maybe this movie works. No, it doesn't. Okay, so it's dinner time. Okay, so I've kind of talked about the turbo boost, and thank you very much.